This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So a Liverpool-Chelsea Carabao Cup final feels like that's the final every year with Manchester City winning it. Both semi-finals were hanging on, a knife edge going into the second legs, but quickly fell onto the spreading bit, or whatever the opposite of that analogy is. Chelsea hit Middlesbrough for six. Could this be the turning point? Meanwhile, Liverpool edge past Fulham, who did make it interesting for the last 15 minutes, but the quadruple is still on. While we're on cup fever, there's an FA Cup fourth round to preview. Maidstone fly the non-league flag at Ipswich, while Newport County, mid-table in League Two, host Manchester United. The All-Premier League tie of the round sees holders Man City go to Spurs. Then there's Johnny Lou's genuinely interesting FFP thoughts, a mini vote of confidence for Roy, Calvin Phillips to West Ham, and someone's written us a poem about chicken goujons. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Jordan Jarrett Bryan.
Yo, yo, yo.
And yo, 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 back to you. And hello, Johnny Lou.
Hi.
Let's do the Carabao Cup semi-final second legs then, starting at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea 6, Middlesbrough 1. Tom says Chelsea made it to the final, Max. But the obvious question, where do they need to strengthen to stand a chance of winning it? Speedy McGeady, is there a risk Chelsea, in fact, over-strengthened last summer? I guess, Baz, I mean, I know they were playing a championship side who didn't play very well. And I know I've asked this question before, but is this a glimpse of what Chelsea might become?
God, I don't know. I hope, I'd imagine Chelsea fans hope it's a sign of what they might become. And, you know, Ben Chilwell and Axel Disasee were both excellent, playing as full backs, pushing high, putting Borough players under all sorts of pressure. And, you know, that one of them's a newish signing, one's an established figure who's just back from injury and was very impressive back from injury. I think we kind of tend to forget how key the absence of Reece James and Ben Chilwell are for Chelsea. But I wouldn't read too much into this because I was very disappointed with Middlesbrough's performance. It was revealed yesterday that, contrary to what everyone thought, two-legged semi-finals in the Carabao Cup will remain. I'm not sure of the nitty-gritty of it, but it's an EFL decision, and their chairman or chief executive, Trevor Birch, said that, you know, these two-legged semi-finals are important for EFL clubs because they make money out of them, but they also massively decrease or significantly decrease these clubs' chances of winning these semi-finals. You know, Borough beat Chelsea at the Riverside, and if it was a one-legged thing, they'd be through. But because of the second leg, he always sort of worried Chelsea had overturned the deficit, and my, how they did it. And while Borough have nothing to be ashamed of losing against Chelsea over two legs, I'd say they'll be massively disappointed by how poor they were in that second leg, because they just made it so easy for Chelsea, kept giving them the ball, played it into their hands, made stupid mistakes playing out from the back, didn't learn from them, and it was really easy for Chelsea in the end.
Yeah, Johnny, Baz says there's not a whole lot you can read into this. I mean, could you read a little bit more into it, bearing in mind we have at least some time to fill on this pod?
Well, Barry mentioned this about Chilwell. I thought he was the real... the key to what Chelsea are trying to do. And if you remember the first few weeks under Pochettino, before Chilwell got injured, he was one of their key players. And he was looking like, you know, he was playing on the left wing and he was looking like he was going to be a key part of this side. And if you think back through the Pochettino teams, particularly at Spurs, the importance of those fullbacks, not just having attacking fullbacks who can sort of pop up at the back post and have this incredible engine, but having depth in those positions as well. That's always been key to how he likes to set up. And so when he got injured, Chelsea were kind of forced into, you know, he kind of had to play Colwill at left back for a long time because Thiago Silva was playing on that side and he doesn't necessarily have the engine to cover those spaces anymore. He needed to play a slightly more defensive player on that side. And it affected the whole way that Chelsea wanted to build up under Pochettino. But if Chilwell is back and he's fit, and not only does that give him a really great chance of getting into the Euro 2024 squad and forcing his way into the England side, but it totally changes the complexion of how Chelsea want to attack. And that's I think what we saw. Even, you know, maybe we can say that 6-1 flattered them. You know, Middlesbrough had some injuries. They had some, I think, three cup ties, three players on international duty. So it wasn't a fair game, but it wasn't a fair reflection of where they are. And they probably want to, if the Chelsea's ownership will probably want to amortize some of those six goals over the next few games. But it was a really impressive professional performance, particularly in the way that they managed to press high and built play.
I've just got to say that I've got a Chelsea supporting father, and I've highly enjoyed.
Makes it sound like you have more than one father there. Like you have a selection of fathers. And we're now talking about your Chelsea supporting one.
You're right. My dad.
As opposed to the top DJ.
Yeah.
We were all very surprised to learn about some time ago.
Yeah, that one. He supports Chelsea, and I've had a lot of fun this year ripping the hell out of him as to how bad they are. But something he's always said to me over the last 10 years and more is that, and it's really annoying, it's kind of his mantra, we're Chelsea, we win trophies, it's what we do. And annoyingly, it's like, there's that as well. But it's just really annoying that even at their worst or at their bang average, they still manage to get to finals and potentially win cups. And, you know, they've not been good this season, but they're in another final. Fair play to them. Just a quick point on Middlesbrough as well. There was a lot of criticism about how they, you know, didn't change how they played, and they kept getting caught at the back, and playing from the back was really poor. I'm a big believer in, I think Pep says it as well, and if he says it, he must be right, that there's no plan B, right? It's make plan A work, make plan A better. And again, Ange Postecoglou, who has got a lot of heat for refusing to change how he played. Vincent Kompany's getting it at Burnley. And I just really back managers that back the way they play. And although Middlesbrough didn't get it right, I don't think the solution was for them to change how they played. It was just to be better and a bit more flexible in plan A. So I just wanted to make the point that I thought they got a lot of unfair criticism for trying to do what has worked for them so far. Just on this night, it wasn't executed very well.
I was tempted to ask what your dad's feelings towards Aston Villa, but I might park that for a second. Barry, Pochettino said, I'm desperate to win a title here, i.e. a trophy. In 1 year and a half in Paris, we won three trophies and we want to win one here. I'm desperate to win, of course, which is great revisionism for a PSG manager, isn't it? Because he famously didn't win Ligue 1 once, which is clearly enormous, but he's turned that into we won three trophies in 1.5 years.
Yeah, it's a sort of a Mourinho-esque massage of the figures, isn't it? Yeah, well, of course he wants to win trophies. And he does have a, you know, it is constantly pointed out by his detractors that he's lost, what is it, two finals during his time in English, was it two or three?
Champions League final, Carabao Cup final, I can't remember any others.
So, you know, we have a repeat now of the Carabao Cup final in 2022 and indeed the FA Cup final in 2022. I think the Carabao Cup final wasn't too bad and Liverpool won on penalties. That was the game in which Kepa Arrizabalaga was brought on for the shootout. Please don't pill me up on whatever it is I just called him. I haven't said his name for quite a long time. And he ended up missing the decisive spot kick. And then Liverpool won the FA Cup final as well on penalties, and that wasn't a very good game. So Chelsea, I suppose, are due one. I think Liverpool will probably win the final. There's an inevitability about it, seems to be, because they don't lose too many games, and but you never know.
So Liverpool through after a 1-1 draw at Craven Cottage. This game was pretty exciting after the Fulham equaliser, Johnny. I think once Liverpool scored early on, you thought that might be it. And Bernd Leno should have done a lot better. But we did have a kind of last 15. Harry Wilson had that one chance. You just wanted Fulham to create a little bit more after they scored.
Yeah, it was interesting that, I mean, I think Marco Silva afterwards said that Fulham got too emotional And, you know, the people who were at the ground were saying that the stadium announcer was going like, this is history. This is our chance of history. History could be made tonight, guys. And, you know, you wonder whether they maybe played up that side of it, you know, a little bit much, because Fulham haven't, you know, they haven't been at this stage. I think it's something like 8 semi-finals in their history, something like that. And, you know, it's possible they just got a little bit nervy and they started really badly. And then, you know, they made a game of it in the last half hour. Harry Wilson, who from the times I've seen him playing for Fulham, I don't know why he doesn't play more for them in the Premier League. I guess Fulham fans would have a better answer to that. But yeah, Fulham really went at them in the last 20, 25 minutes in a way that made you wonder, you know, what if they'd had a proper go at Liverpool right from the start? Because Liverpool were, you know, it wasn't quite a full strength side, you know, that they played a lot of the kids and they played a lot of, you know, fringe players. So it was kind of a mix of youth and experience. And I actually thought it was really impressive the way they saw that game out. If you think about the lack of experience, you know, Bradley and Kwanzaa, I thought had a good game. I mean, I also want to mention like that this incredible, like Klopp sends on Bobby Clark with 7 minutes to go. And that's the point at which the tie is right on a knife edge. And I just love the trust of Klopp going to the, you know, Bobby Clark, go on, see this out, like cup semi-final. And he does it. He played really well. So that I think is the difference between these two sides, just that kind of institutional knowledge of how these, you know, how to get the job done, basically.
And it's interesting actually, Jordan, isn't it? Johnny mentions Clark there, Conor Bradley as well. Seeing young players coming into a confident team. Clearly, these are all very good players, but God, it helps.
It does. And I think the coaching around that and the environment that's created is a massive, massive part of that. They're having a decent to good season this year. And I think having talented players who are young, and as I mentioned, are in an environment created by the manager and the coaching staff to do their best work is essential. I thought Fulham were good. I was disappointed they didn't really go for it a bit earlier in the match. I thought that they kind of tried to feel out Liverpool a bit too long before going for it, was my interpretation of the match. But I think had they gone for Liverpool a little bit earlier, they might have had a little bit more joy.
I thought they started quite well, but like Borough the night before, they kept giving the ball away sloppily when they should have done better. And they had two pretty good chances in the first half before Liverpool scored. One was when Pereira picked out Palhinha at a corner, and he had all the time in the world to pick his spot for the volley and blast it over the bar, and he should have scored. I expected more from a player of his quality. And then I think soon after that, there was an Anthony Robinson cross from the left, a real vicious cross, and Queeving Kelleher got a vital touch to deny Bobby Cordoba Reed at the far post. And I think if one of those had gone in, you know, Fulham could have gone the other way. And then Diaz scored. Jarrell Kwanzaa is another young player who was playing for Liverpool, and he was instrumental in setting up that goal with his lovely sort of Trent Alexander-Arnold-esque diagonal up towards Luis Diaz. I have a theory about this game. I think when Liverpool scored that goal and then half time came, I reckon almost the entire audience will have switched over to Traitors on BBC.
Right.
Because it was the first night of the final week of Traitors. And wow, it'll have been, you know, Liverpool are done, that's it, game over, let's watch Traitors. So no one will have seen Fulham's reasonably spirited fight back in the second half.
And who's the favourite to win Traitors?
Oh, don't spoil it, Barry. I'm two episodes behind.
Okay. Don't answer that question. Is it Gavin or Chanel? I mean, I'm not watching, so I...
No Gavin, no Chanel. A lot of them are very, very thick. Yeah. That's all I'll say. Right. Just incredibly thick.
Right, okay.
So the guy who I think is going to win, although I suspect the way it's being edited, he may not, it won't be because he's incredibly clever. It's just the rest of them are just so thick.
I just wonder from a Fulham perspective, is this a danger in, you know, you take this competition seriously, you play all the games, you get a bit tired, you go out in the semi-finals, no one remembers that. And so actually you'd be better off not taking the competition seriously, or is that just a daft question?
I think you have to take it seriously, don't you? If you're Fulham, I mean, they're not going to get relegated. They're not going to be challenging for Europe. So, of course, they should take cup seriously.
Mm. It's been a while since a team has made a mistake with things for supporters. I think it was Brighton. the Brighton ponchos of maybe 5 years ago that made it look like they had started a new, I don't know what are they called? You know, the... What are the Ku Klux Klan? What's their sort of
a rally?
Not a rally. You know, like I don't know what's their home base. Fortunately, I'm not very knowledgeable on this. But Bumba says, was it a surprise to see Fulham confirm themselves as the London branch of the KKK? Yes, they laid out the flags in a really. I mean, it was funny because it's a moment in time when they were all waving. It looked great, but when they were all just laid on the seats, someone must have sat back and gone, oh dear, this really doesn't look very good. But anyway,
Leicester did this. I remember Leicester doing this a few years ago. There was they were playing a Champions League game during their Champions League season, and they put, you know, it was basically the same. They put white flags on all the seats, but because of the way the flags were falling, it just looked like they filled the entire King Power Stadium with very, very small clan
tiny
members.
Grand Wizards.
And to be fair, as you're putting the flags down on the seat, that gentleman or that team wouldn't have seen it from 50 meters back. So to be fair to Fulham, they wouldn't have known that until
you don't in the risk assessment, you don't think that what will this look like from afar?
Look from there,
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, maybe the next team won't make that mistake. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look ahead to the fourth round of the FA Cup. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We normally get told off for not talking about Monday Night Football. Imagine we would get told off for talking about Monday Night Football. It was so long ago and Brighton and Wolves drew 0-0. James Milner did overtake Ryan Giggs to claim second in the all-time Premier League appearances list. He's now just 20 behind Gareth Barry. So, you know, look forward to when he overtakes that. It would be some achievement from young James. FA Cup fourth round. Ipswich Maidstone. Shall we start there? George Adekobi delighted with the draw away at Ipswich because he says it's a fantastic location geographically. It is reachable for our Maidstone community. He says, not wrong, just 1 hour 33 by car. Worth noting, if you're going by train, there is a reduced service on Greater Anglia between Colchester and Ipswich.
I just wonder, would it be quicker by boat? Would Maidstone to Ipswich be quicker by boat? Like shorter distance, surely.
I don't know how near the water Maidstone is.
Maidstone is like North Kent. Not coastal, yes. But I mean probably a short hop to, I don't know, maybe Sheerness
Rochester.
Or Rochester.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're getting an oyster boat and you know, and
well, a Sunderland supporting pal of mine went to Ipswich a couple of weeks ago to watch Sunderland get beaten and 2-1. And I think that there was real difficulties then, and he had to do quite a large chunk of the journey on a rail replacement bus, and that would be enough to put me off going, definitely.
Mm. Producer Joel says, you're looking at the Tilbury Ferry from Gravesend to Essex. Uh-huh. But can't be quicker. Anyway, I mean, I don't expect, Barry, you know everything about Maidstone United, but it's not a terrible draw for them. I mean, they would have liked a bigger side in it, but Ipswich are going well, and, you know, you never know.
Well, I guess they're happy enough with Ipswich, but they would have liked a home draw, obviously. And I mean, this fourth round draw, there's five all Premier League ties, four all Championship ties, and then Maidstone are away, Newport are at home, Wrexham are away, publicity-starved Wrexham, who were on the TV on Monday night. Their game against Blackburn is on Monday. And this round, like the last one, is spread out for over Thursday through to Monday, which is, you know, I suppose it doesn't really matter, does it? But Maidstone, yes. Well, I think we've spoken about their history after their third round win. You know, they've been really... had it tough, were slung out of the league, ended up playing in the fourth division of the Kent Counties League, worked their way back up to the National League, then got relegated after a couple of seasons, and for a while they didn't have a ground. We had their chief executive on the radio the day after the third round win, tremendously entertaining man, some great stories. He seems to have led a very full and eventful life in football. And he's been...
Bill Williams was his name.
Yeah, Bill has been connected with the club for decades, you know, being there for the very worst of times, and now he's there for the very best of times. So good luck to them.
What chance do you give Newport County over Manchester United, Jordan? This seems like, if the round is ripe for an upset, this is probably the one that people want, right?
You'll want it, yeah. I don't think it will happen, unfortunately. It'll be hilarious if it did happen. But I think United are kind of in that kind of groove now where they know they're teetering on the brink. And if they lose games like this, it's going to just fall to a new low, a new level of embarrassment. So I expect them to get the job done here.
Bristol City, Nottingham Forest, Liverpool, Norwich. I can only see Luis Suarez scoring 8 in this game. Bournemouth, Swansea and West Brom, Wolves, the other sort of possible upsets. Spurs, Man City, probably the tie of the round, Johnny, certainly from an all-Premier League point of view. Madison might be back for Spurs. It should be an open game, shouldn't it? It was 3-3 at the Etihad. Man City have never scored at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And you just sense that when they break that duck, they will really break that duck.
That they've famously had a penalty in the first leg of that Champions League quarterfinal, which Aguero missed. It's an annoying one for City because they are obviously, you know, they've got a huge kind of slate of league fixtures coming up and players that they are trying to, that Guardiola will be trying to ease back into the side, you know, whether it's Haaland trying to get or De Bruyne. And you would probably have wanted something a little bit easier than this. But going to Spurs, especially Spurs with their, I don't know, is it kind of, you know, parodic to call it cup heritage these days? Because they haven't actually won the thing since 1991. But there is, I think, an expectation, particularly after the way Spurs went out of the Carabao Cup, that they're going to have I think Spurs fans are expecting them to have a pretty solid tilt at the cup this season, and especially if they beat City, they will genuinely believe they can go on and win it, and they'll have a proper go. Obviously, as we know, a Postecoglou side will almost certainly put out a full strength or nearly full strength side. Madison might be back, I think Lo Celso might be out, but generally a pretty full strength side, and it should be an incredible game. I mean, I don't know if we're talking sort of 2004 levels, but it's like it's coming up to the 20th anniversary of that famous 4-3 game, right? Which you know, the one,
the John Macken header,
the John Macken game.
Yeah, ah, yes.
Where they come back from 3-0 down. And so, yeah, I mean, all the ingredients are there. I think it's Friday. It's Friday night, right? That's probably the tie of the round.
It's interesting that it was Gary Mabbutt who paired Spurs with Manchester City, and the look of horror on his face when he saw what he'd done. It's not the first time he's done possibly irreparable harm to Tottenham's chances of winning the FA Cup. Let's just say, poor old Gary.
What does your heart tell you is going to happen in this, Jordan?
I think Spurs might do it. I agree with Johnny. I think Spurs are going to really... I think they've put a lot of emphasis this year in wanting to take the FA Cup seriously. I think they know they need a cup. They do have a decent record of recent times against Manchester City. I don't think it will be because City are poor. I just think Spurs will turn up. I take no joy in saying that, but I'll go for Spurs.
The British billionaire Joe Lewis pleaded guilty on Wednesday to charges that he used insider trading scheme to enrich friends and associates, and apologised to a judge. I'm so embarrassed. I apologise to the court for my conduct, he said. He founded Enix Sport, the company that owns the vast majority of shares in Spurs. In a statement last year to The Athletic, a Spurs spokesman said the owner of Tottenham Hotspur is Enix, with majority control held by a family discretionary trust, of which Joe Lewis is not a beneficiary. He ceased to be a person with significant control in the club in October 2022. This is a US legal matter unconnected with the club, and as such, we have no further comment. The Lewis Family Trust effectively controls just over 60% of the club's shares. His guilty plea, according to The Athletic, does not therefore impact the day-to-day running of the club or give them problems with the Premier League owners and directors' tests. Is it convenient, Johnny, that Joe Lewis became no longer the owner of Tottenham at around the time this case began?
Yeah, well, that famous defence, like they would say that, wouldn't they? We don't obviously have the time to go into it here, but if you look at like Joe Lewis's history, you know, business history, some of the stuff he's done, business dealings, there's not a lot to feel proud of there for Spurs fans. You know, I think Spurs fans are pretty quick to talk about other clubs' owners, you know, whether it's Newcastle or City, or you know, they're very quick to point the finger at other clubs for where their money comes from and how it's been earned. And I think this is just a reminder that nobody is holier than thou on this.
Ed Aaron's writing regarding Roy Hodgson. He understands Roy is set to remain in charge of Crystal Palace for next week's game against Sheffield United after holding talks with Steve Parrish, the chairman, after the Arsenal defeat. That and games against Brighton and Chelsea will be crucial in determining his future. So a stay of execution, I guess. Calvin Phillips has joined West Ham on loan with an option to buy. That seems like a good idea, Barry, doesn't it, for all parties?
Just getting out of Man City is a good idea for Calvin Phillips because his career has really stagnated since he moved there, despite the fact that, you know, he's won a treble last season. I'll be honest, with the greatest respect to West Ham, I thought he'd go somewhere a bit better, a more elite club. But he just needs to get playing football, doesn't he? And David Moyes is clearly very keen on him. I'm not sure he's exactly what West Ham need, but they are certainly what he needs.
Mm. I mean, interestingly, you say he could have gone somewhere better. I wonder, Jordan, if everyone's fit, I know Paquetá's out for a bit, but does he even start for West Ham with Edson Álvarez and James Ward-Prowse just behind Paquetá?
I don't think he walks into that starting 11, but I definitely think he's more than capable of competing to get into that team. I personally think this move, a bit like Jordan Henderson as well, is driven by the fact that the third spot in the England team for this Euro Summers isn't locked down. I think we know Bellingham and Rice will start, and I think that they would have gone to the one with the squad anyway. But I reckon Phillips and Henderson are both thinking to themselves, I can start potentially in that team in a Euros where England could win it. He needs to obviously get himself, as you mentioned, into the West Ham team first of all, but I can see that happening. And I disagree with Barry slightly. I'm not so sure he could have got a bigger team than West Ham. I think West Ham's probably the kind of level of where Calvin Phillips is. What kind of club, Barry, was you thinking he could have potentially moved to?
Well, I think Barcelona are crying out for a player of his qualities, but then there's the...
No, there was some talk of Barcelona wanting a little cut price deal for him, right?
But the problem there, I suppose, is that Citigroup own Girona, who are top of the La Liga, and would they want to help Barcelona out? Possibly, you know, probably not, considering the lofty position in which Girona find themselves. There was talk of him maybe going to Newcastle as well. West Ham are higher in the league table than Newcastle, but you know, the Newcastle project, in inverted commas, is probably more ambitious than the West Ham one. So West Ham's all right. You know, he just needs to get playing and try and get himself back in the English team. You're smirking, Max. Why are you smirking?
It's just sort of damning with faint praise for West Ham, you know, this club with years of history, you know, who won a European trophy, and they said, well, they're all right. I mean, I think you're right. That's sort of about how good they are. It sounded quite flippant. That's why I was laughing.
But to be fair, they have won silverware, lots of silverware since Newcastle last won silverware. But, you know, Newcastle are the richest club in the world.
Yeah.
But no, no. But are comically hamstrung by the fact that they can't spend any of their money.
Well, you mentioned Newcastle, and they turned down quite a big bid for Trippier, more than they paid for him, considering he's 33. They've turned down bids for Callum Wilson. Now, Miguel Almiron is subject of interest from Al-Shabaab in the Saudi League. Worth noting, they're not owned by PIF Al-Shabaab directly. Johnny, your thoughts on that potential transfer?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the kind of the official version of events, and which is also, I think, the official version that is it's also the version that most of the Newcastle-based journalists have come up with through their independent digging. I think we can assume this is what's actually happening. Basically, Almiron, you know, Newcastle needs to comply with fair play for financial fair play. So Almiron is surplus to requirements. He's not good enough for that team anymore, but not so surplus to requirements that he wouldn't command like a really strong bid. You know, they're not going to get lowballed for something like Almiron. You know, they're not desperate to get rid of him. He's still, you know, he was a key part of the squad that qualified them for the Champions League last season. And so a bid has come in from Al-Shabaab, who I think he's president. I mean, they're not one of the PIF owned clubs, but they are one of the biggest clubs in the Saudi Pro League, and their president comes from a prominent family of Saudi businessmen. So obviously will have done lots of deals with the state, through the state. Not this, okay. I'm not assuming that any kind of deal has been done here. But basically a bid has come in, and this bid is not, you know, it's not like a low-ball first bid. You know, normally first bids are quite derisory, right? You know that they're desperate to sell. But no, this bid has been, an agreement has already been made, that they've agreed a fee. So it's like a bid that is not, it's not so low that they would reject it or negotiate it or you know, they go through some sort of public protracted bargaining process. No, they've just accepted that bid. But it's fair market value. It's not like, it's not so big that it would be kind of, suspicious under the fair market regulations of the profit and sustainability rules. So I mean, it's very lucky for Newcastle, really, that they've managed to, that a player who they didn't want to sell but also had to sell, somebody's come up with a bid for him that is the perfect bid. It's pitched at the perfect level that is fair market value, but not, you know, so low that they would have to reject it and negotiate a higher one. So, I mean, it's just very fortunate. That's the official version of events anyway. And I think we should all accept that official version of events, you know, if we value the structural integrity of our bones.
While we're on FFP and PSR and all the charges, Johnny, you actually wrote I sound surprised. Your pieces are good, but like an interesting piece on FFP is quite an achievement. And I will read a bit out because I thought it was interesting. We're fighting in 2024 the battles that should have been fought in 2014 and 2004 or even earlier. Decisions that were botched, shirked, ignored years ago and now coming home to roost. The unregulated free-for-all that allowed first the oligarchs and then the venture capitalists and then the state actors to claim a piece of our turf. Players signed for ridiculous sums by sporting directors and owners who are now long gone. The decision to let the Super League breakaway clubs slide back into the competition with a paltry £3.7 million fine for their trouble. Do you think right now these charges are kind of a watershed moment? Or your piece was basically saying it feels, even if the Premier League are doing the right thing by these charges, and I'm not saying they are, I'm not saying you're saying they are, the fact that they are doing it still feels not quite right.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with this debate, you know, so to call it, is that both sides kind of have a point in that obviously you need some kind of financial regulation to stop unregulated overspending, but you can also very strongly argue that the Premier League have no kind of, certainly no moral authority to or the required trust to administer those regulations. I think both sides kind of have a point here. This is the same Premier League who for decades basically turned a blind eye to this stuff, who built the entire brand of the Premier League on no questions asked, come and bring your money to the Premier League, stuff the coffers and buy whoever you want, do whatever you want, we won't ask any questions. And So now for the Premier League to then say, well, we're gonna stamp down hard on these, you know, slightly smaller clubs, not the big clubs, but that, you know, that we're gonna punish Everton and Nottingham Forest first. You can see why fans of those clubs are like, hang on, this is a little bit rich and it's a little bit hypocritical. And so yeah, I don't necessarily know what the answer is beyond a proper regulator with actual teeth who can say to, you know, state owners, no, you're not doing that. Or saying to owners like Dai Young at Reading, this is not your club anymore. We are literally taking this club off your hands. And unless a regulator has those kinds of powers, then we are basically just, you know, we are continuing to fight the battles of 10, 20 years ago, trying to regulate a game that has already been warped and bent and destabilized by the actions that were taken, you know, a generation ago.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll do any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. An update on the racist abuse of Mike Maignan, the AC Milan keeper. Four Udinese fans have been banned for life by the club. Udinese can confirm it's identified four further individuals relating to the incident of discrimination towards Mike Maignan. These individuals will be banned from the stadium for life. Udinese have been ordered to play one match behind closed doors, Jordan. Troy Townsend, our friend, said, oh, the old match behind closed doors routine. We are tired of it all. Tired. Those most affected, he says, are tired of it all. Tired. Is behind closed doors never the answer now? Should it be more severe? Should it be more games behind closed doors? Or is that a bad idea?
Yeah, I think the problem that Troy has with, and many people have with, behind closed doors is the amount of games. So obviously a club will lose revenue if they don't have fans in the ground, right? But being banned for having fans in for one game, the revenue loss there is minimal. If it was going to be 10 games behind closed doors, 15 games, then, you know, I don't want to speak for Troy, but he may well feel that is a bit more of a deterrent. I've got two quick points I want to make on this. People often talk about fines not being the answer because football clubs are so rich. And I've maybe said that myself, but I'm going to stretch a point here to make my point. It's the amount of fine. The amount of money that they are fined, right? So if there was a rule that said, if your club is deemed to have, you know, I don't know, players who have racially abused someone or fans who have racially abused someone, there's a £60 million fine, then that would put a lot of clubs out of business. That could be a deterrent. So I'm exaggerating a point to make a point. Fining clubs isn't necessarily not the answer. It's the amount that these clubs are often fined, which makes it laughable. And if I could make a second, almost parallel point in regards to off the field of play, you know, what could be done. You, Max, and producer Joel invited me on to the Guardian Football Weekly for my first ever appearance on here a couple of weeks after George Floyd had been murdered. I was on with Troy that one. We had a really interesting discussion around what sports media and indeed the wider world can do to better race relations. We had a really good chat. I think you heard me on TalkSport the week before talking about the same thing, and I called out TalkSport on TalkSport about what they need to do, and rah, rah, rah. And on The Guardian episode, I mentioned also The Guardian could do a lot more to invite Black contributors onto the podcast to talk about these issues, talk about footballing issues and not just about racism in football. And to be fair to The Guardian, you've done that. I've been on the pod now for 3 years and I'm very, very, very grateful and thankful, and I enjoy coming on the pod. I think there's a potential of the sports media industry that's also improved in that we are able to have credible voices talk about this issue in a way that is from the voices of people who are affected by racism in this sport. But also, I think in our media, and I think this wider media problem, is that we're still having this discussion of, is football racist? In the same way I hear certain radio stations ask the question, is Britain racist? And that for me is very problematic because it makes me think that isn't the question. We're past that. We're really past that. The question should be, what are we prepared to do to eradicate racism from the country, but in regards to this podcast, football. That's the discussion we need to be having here. And I think in terms of off the field of play, what we as journalists can do is ensure that when we have podcasts, when we have radio stations, when we have TV programs, we are having the right people discuss these issues. And I just wanted to kind of make the point that I think since my first appearance on the podcast, I've seen so much improvement in where the media has spoken about this issue of racism in football with the people that actually know what it's like to be racially abused. So it's a very long-winded way of me kind of applauding The Guardian Football Weekly and some parts of our media, but other parts of our media, I think, are still well behind because they're still having that question of, is football racist? And for me, that is an issue because we're just well past that. That isn't the question anymore.
No. I guess what Udinese would say is, we found the culprits, we've banned them for life. That's what we should do.
That is what they should do, but I think they should still be, I still hold clubs responsible for the fans that are in there, that follow their football club. That maybe seem harsh, sounds harsh. And a lot of people take issue with the possible points deduction. Oh, why should we all feel the brunt of a few idiots? Mm-hmm. But I'm really sorry. I think a serious issue requires serious consequences. And if we all have to feel the brunt of that for the minority, then I'm sorry, but that is where we are, because my response is, what's the alternative?
Mm-hmm. Or in the sense that it creates an anti-racist environment at the club.
Right, and you know, Borussia Dortmund, for example, they proactively, you know, educate fans on, for example, the Holocaust or anti-Semitism. You know, they run courses, they run visits to Auschwitz and other concentration camps. They try and proactively, before an incident happens, they try and create a culture that says racism is not tolerated. This isn't us. This is not who we are. And if you could do anything like that, you are not one of us. Doing that work in a proactive way, instead of reacting to the incident. And I agree that, you know, identifying and banning fans is a lot further than actually a lot of other teams are prepared to go, especially when it puts them into conflict with their own ultras. So fair enough that, you know, their reaction has been fine, but it's what was the environment, what was the culture that allowed these incidents to happen in the first place? And I think, you know, the principle of collective responsibility means that Udinese, they do have to take some share of the blame for that as well.
Moving on to AFCON, and thanks to everyone who enjoyed the special that we did on AFCON, and it went down very well, and it was a really fun panel. We will do another one. We've got one soon booked in, producer Joel says. It has been so good, so many shocks, late goals. It is worth pointing out, though, that yesterday, it is a real shame that Hakim Ziyech scored for Morocco, because otherwise we would have had Namibia 0, Mali 0, South Africa 0, Tunisia 0, Tanzania 0, DR Congo 0, Zambia 0, Morocco 0. But Morocco spoiled it by scoring one, although their group is the best, because only Morocco have won a match in the group. Congo came second with 3 points, 3 draws, and Zambia third, 2 points. Tanzania on 2 as well. But yes, it's good to see naught in the win column of 3 teams. The last 16s begin on Saturday. Jim says, thoughts on Eric Dier going full Steve McLaren? He made his debut coming on at half-time in a 1-0 win over Union Berlin for Bayern. I don't know if you've seen this clip, Barry, have you? Has anyone seen it?
I have, yes.
It's good fun, isn't it?
He went a bit hello, didn't he?
And he hasn't been there very long. I mean, that's the amazing thing, isn't it? It's literally like you just land there and you just can't help yourself. I suppose I go Cockney when I get in a taxi. So it's the same thing, really, isn't it? You just start talking like the person who's talking to you.
It's a basic sign of humanity, isn't it? It shows that you kind of empathise with your audience. I think, you know, it's this stuff gets slightly unfairly ridiculed, because I think, you know, trying to adjust your message or your tone to your audience is actually quite a nice thing to do.
Yeah, good on Eric. Oscar says, dear Max and the gang, I can't comment on the current spate of Rushdening in Vera. Yes, this is off the back of a Rushden family appearing in Vera, and whether that is just a coincidence or they're big Football Weekly fans. I have it on excellent authority that the just-published murder mystery Hell and Death, or Hella and Death, contains a series of clues, or possibly red herrings, in homage to a certain pundit's obsession with crime, including a back issue of The Blizzard. There's also a character in it called Wilson. For the record, this is a shameful coincidence and should not be taken as a reason to inflate his ego still further. Yours with love, Oscar Jensen, listener since 2014, and author of the just-published murder mystery Hella and Death. Anyway, go and buy Oscar's book. David says, hi, Max and the gang. My best friend, Shaka, also a listener of the pod, is getting married on the 27th of January, i.e. on Saturday, to his partner, Emma. I was just hoping for a vintage Barry message. I think he'll be more enthused about this one, as whilst love is a factor, another reason is that being married means they get stuff cheaper, i.e. rental cars, when they visit America. True love, that. Shaka and Emma. Baz, away you go.
David's made a schoolboy error here, because he's given me nothing to work with, just that Shaka is tight and he's only marrying Emma for the financial breaks that their nuptials will bring. I believe you get tax breaks as well if you're married that you wouldn't otherwise get. Then there's pensions, stuff like that. Widow's pension, you know, you wouldn't get that. Emma wouldn't get that if Shaka did.
I think it takes like 30 or 40 years of those benefits to pay off the average.
So widow's pension is a really, it's an odd place to go to start with, isn't it? Seems quite far, hopefully quite far in the future, doesn't it?
David hasn't told us how old Shaka and Emma are. They could be in their early 60s. So, I mean, I appreciate that many see me on my role on Football Weekly as some sort of dancing bear who will perform on request. But I really need more material to work with.
Oh, fine. But it's only in 2 days. Can you not just at least wish them some happiness?
Yeah. I hope they're very happy together for as long as the marriage lasts.
Yeah. Speaking of being the Football Weekly dancing bear, I think it was off the back of Cristiano Ronaldo saying, I'm 44 and I look great, or however old it is, 39, whatever he is. Ergonomic says, when will I be able to buy the I'm 51 soon and I look like a sack of shit t-shirt? Which was your comment to that, Barry? Maybe we'll add them to Football Weekly merchandise. Jordan, you've got a new podcast. You're allowed to plug it here. Is it good?
I think it's very, very good. Thank you very much. It's me and three mates. It's called Not For Clicks. It's football centered, but it's also sports. So we look at other sports and discuss what's happening in other sports. We don't really focus too much on games. So it's no competition with the Guardian Football Weekly. We more kind of focus on issues than actual game to game stuff. And it's just the four guys having a laugh. And as you do on here, and let me push my anti-Villa agenda, it's basically an hour of that on my podcast over there. So,
but it's not for clicks.
It's not for clicks.
No one gets accused of clickbait in the responses to this podcast more than you. But, you know, it's good you've had an about turn here.
Thank you very much.
Finally, Rian has written us a poem about chicken goujons. The email was marked urgent, please read. Okay. In a pub so snug with laughter aglow, Barry and Max, friends in the know, a platter arrived, a feast to be, chicken goujons, crispy and free. Barry's wit, sharp as a knife, Max's humour, the spice of life. They shared the joy in every bite. They shared the joy in every bite, goujons dipped in tails so light. As crispy crumbs danced in the air, friendship flourished beyond compare. Barry and Max, a duo so grand, in chicken goujons, they found a strand, says Rian. From Rian in Manchester.
It's like the Iceland Christmas advert.
Is chicken goujons... That's not Urban Dictionary, Barry, for something, is it?
Not that I'm aware of. If his poem was called Alabama Steamboat, then
wow.
Yeah, I'd have cut you off really? Early doors.
Okay, well...
Are we in some way... Do we have some connection to chicken goujons that I've completely forgotten about?
I don't think so. I mean, I'd happily share a platter of chicken goujons with you, Barry, next time we're in the same room.
I was at home in Burr last week visiting Maya Glendening, and we had no electricity the first day of my... because the men were fixing the pylons on our street, and electricity pylons as opposed to...
Yeah, the pylons internet. We're used to, yes.
Social media yeah. pylons. I took Ma out for lunch, and I had scampi rather than chicken goujons. So if you could write a poem about scampi, then I'm here right. for it.
It would be more fitting. I mean, that really will do for today. But thank you so much for your time. Thanks, Barry.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson.
This is The Guardian.